The big question, and this changes for everyone, is why do you buy a wine? And do you know where that wine actually comes from?
As I like to say, there's life after Cabernet Sauvignon.
The most expensive wine in the world is a Bloody Merlot. Why can't we be in that group? We can be.
It is important to adapt your rootstock to the location where you are and what you want to grow.
There's a moment in a red wine fermentation where it gets really foamy, froths up in your face, and it smells amazing. I think that's my favorite part.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And welcome to podcast number 300. This week we feature Casey Wiersba of Shady Lane Cellars on the Leelanau Peninsula near Traverse City, Michigan. There is a great deal of pride that goes with making Michigan wine. These winemakers are creating some very special wines that are just waiting to be discovered. In fact, there are nearly 200 operating wineries in the state. We caught up with one of those winemakers in November during our Michigan wine tour. Casey Wiersba is winemaker at Shady Lane Cellars on the Leelanau Peninsula near Traverse City. The tasting room is unique, and the wine is very good. Casey has tireless energy, which from our point of view, is fueled by grapes. So continuing with our tour of Michigan wineries, we are here at Shady Lane Cellars, and I'm here with Casey Wiersba, and Casey's the winemaker here. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
Thank you for meeting with us early on a Saturday morning, which I'm probably not your day off, I imagine, this time of year.
Not this time of year. I'm actually going to do a couple punch downs while I'm here.
Great. So. And we'll be able to see that a little bit later on in our video. Excellent. A little churn of weather last night for us. There's snow all over the place, a lot more than anybody expected. And I would imagine as winemaker, you're kind of like, boy, glad I got my grapes off the vines.
We have a couple grapes out there.
Do you?
We do. We are going to pick late harvest Riesling, hopefully later this week. So we like to pick it when it's slushy. Of course, concentration of sugars and Brix that way. And then there's still that great acidity that Riesling always provides. So late harvest Riesling's usually a home run up here.
Yeah, but picking it's got to be kind of challenging because it's going to be theoretically cold.
It is. And all of our grapes are hand-picked. So we have this fantastic crew that's been working with us for years. Actually, two of the couples have been here. They're the longest standing employees. So they know the vineyard in and out. They planted it. But yeah, it's kind of a rough day. We take it slow. We try to make it as fun as it can.
Yeah, good. That's a good thing in the cold. Of course, then again, if you're from this kind of area, you're used to this kind of thing anyway, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So as for you as a winemaker, first of all, how long have you been with Shady Lane?
Since 2013. So I started as the assistant winemaker and worked under the winemaker who started this winery, Adam Satchwell, and learned the complete ins and outs of the place. It's always so nice to get that foothold and that foundation. And he went away to work at another project, and I was promoted to head winemaker in 2016.
Well, nice. All that work paid off.
It is a lot of work.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, and let's talk about that work, how you became a winemaker. And I guess even before that, was there a time that you had the aha moment with wine, or how did it find its way into your life?
So kind of a combination of things. I like to make things. I like to grow things. And this was from a very young age. So I was the strange child who, when I was homesick, watched PBS cooking shows and had lists of recipes that we needed to go buy ingredients for. So making stuff has always been like just innately inside of me. I love the outdoors. I love growing plants. As a young person, I was kind of drawn to biology, and when I went to Michigan State University with that focus in plant sciences, I kind of started bending my interest into horticulture because I knew that you're studying plants, but you're studying plants for food, for growing something. And as I became more immersed in the department, I discovered this wine thing. I'm from Traverse City, so our industry was just really starting to flourish back then, about 20 years ago. And I did an internship at Black Star Farms and thought, gosh, this is the whole package. This is science, this is craft, and this is what I want to do. So,
have you had an opportunity to visit wineries elsewhere, whether they be in Europe, South America, or out west, or anything like that?
Yeah, well, after I studied horticulture at Michigan State, I got a bachelor's, and then I went on to do a master's with the viticulture and enology lab there. And after living in Michigan, you know, I thought it's time to get out of Dodge. So I went straight to Napa Valley.
Good call.
And why not, right? And I worked there in the industry for 7 years.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah.
Where did you work, if you don't mind me asking?
Sure. I worked at Frog's Leap for 3 harvests. And I worked with the Nickel family at Farniente and Nickel and Nickel for another 3 harvests. In between that time, getting my foot in the door, I started at Rudd Winery. Then I actually went back to Rudd in between Frog's Leap and Nickel and Nickel.
That's a pretty good pedigree, I'd say.
It really is. I wouldn't have changed the experience for anything.
But in the end, you wanted to come home and work in this wine industry here.
I did. Traverse City is home to me. And even though we're in the midst of a snowstorm out there, I love it. So we have 3 seasons here. We're surrounded by lakes, surrounded by one of the natural wonders of the world, the Great Lakes, which are completely imperative to what we do here, growing fruit, growing grapes. So yeah, this is home. And besides it being home, I'm actually making wines that I love to drink personally. I love bright, expressive, aromatic white wines. I love red wines with structure, acidity being kind of at the root and foundation of structure. So yeah, it's home.
And what kind of wines are you making here?
We make quite a few wines. We make about 15 different wines. We don't make them every year, but that's kind of what we play around with. Here at our estate, we have just over 100 acres, 53 are planted, and that's all of the good plantable land. The property is quite undulating, and we have a lot of great air drainage. So when we get those cold snaps and cold weather moving through, it kind of sinks to those areas that we don't have planted. We have another property called Hennessy Vineyard, which is about 4 miles due west of here. Beautiful little property, southerly facing slope, great air drainage there because it all slopes down. And there's about 15 acres planted there.
And just to name a few, you're doing vinifera here, obviously.
We are. So vinifera is our focus. Of course, Riesling is kind of a flagship of the area. And we also grow Cab Franc, Pinot Noir, Blaufränkisch, and Grüner Veltliner, 2 Austrian grape varieties, which have really situated themselves nicely in this area.
Are there a lot of people growing Grüner?
It's growing in popularity. It's not the most cold hardy variety, but we can make it work in certain areas. And of course, it just makes fantastic, expressive, aromatic white wine with a little bit more weight to it, which is nice. We make a sparkling Riesling, which we're all very excited about. It's just such a cool expression of the grape.
And you don't see a lot of sparkling Riesling.
No, we don't. Unless if you're at like a Riesling festival where we're talking about Riesling. But yeah, it's kind of, it's unique. And it's something that's very popular in Germany and Austria, but not here in the States. What's great about sparkling Riesling is that it's not like some just ubiquitous like white grape that you don't know exactly what the variety is. It's just as much about the process of the bubbles as it is about the variety too.
You have a great deal of experience here. Does sparkling wine have a lengthy history in this area in Michigan?
It does, and Larry Mauby was the first one to realize that opportunity. And since then, more and more producers are catching on and maybe not making a whole breadth of sparkling wines, but they're certainly have one or two on their list. And yeah, we're making great, expressive sparkling wines.
Do you see something like that becoming, I don't want to use the word trend because I don't like the word trend, but growing more, because it seems that more people are opening their minds up to sparkling wines and champagne in general. Is that fair to say it's getting more popular or will get more popular?
You know, I'm not afraid of trends because they allow your foot in the door for other wines. You know, rosé was a huge, like, had this huge burst of excitement, especially in the Finger Lakes. New York City grabbed a hold of it, took it and ran with it as like, this is our local wine. These are our local wines. And it's really given them a foot in the door to be in that market, to have a big presence. And so I think if sparkling is a trend, which I don't think it is, because it's a wine style that's suited for this area, it's only going to help us get our other wines into the market and get people experiencing them as well.
Good. Plus, it wakes up people to the fact that, oh, they make sparkling wine
exactly.
In Michigan. Yeah, cool. Here we are. We're in the early part of November, first third of November. And again, you've already mentioned you still have a little bit of harvesting yet to do, but it gives our listeners a bit of a typical, I know there's no such thing as a typical day, but a rough idea. I mean, you start your day, you know, are you tasting the tanks? What do you do? Walk through a day, just kind of quick synopsis.
Sure. During harvest, I try to get into the winery and check up on all of the wines before fruit starts coming in. It's really important because these poor wines in tanks with their little yeast minions working on them, you need to make sure they're all in check. So that's the first thing I do. I come in, I look at the wines in tanks. I check the temperature. I check the bricks. I smell from a glass from the sample I took. I smell on top of the tank just to make sure the fermentation's happy, that it's not spiking out of control and moving too rapidly and not kind of puttering off at least too soon. So I look up on the white wines and the rosés that we make in tanks, and then I head over to the red wine. I do my punch downs. I do kind of the same thing with those. I, you know, as I'm punching down, I smell what kind of aromas are coming off. You can gauge like, oh, is this fermentation really hot? Because you can feel the heat coming off of it. If you don't feel the heat coming off of it, it's like, okay, it's kind of cooler. It's kind of minding. It's way. So yeah, kind of like get a pulse on everything before fruit starts coming in, because when fruit starts coming in, it comes in quick. I often am like hopping on the forklift and then I'm starting to weigh fruit. It sometimes feels like a large operation because we only have three people like actually making the wine. So yeah, it's very fast paced. And we do this for about a month and a half. And then we finally go, thank God that's over.
Then you can have a drink.
Exactly. Yeah, we always start off harvest, you know. We often work later into the evening or early into the next morning. And we always start off, enjoying some beers with dinner. And then by like three quarters of the way through, we're like, should we have a cup of coffee? I know it's 11 o'clock at night, but I'm 9.
Well, you know, there's that classic saying, it takes a lot of beer to make good wine.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that makes complete sense. Now, you had mentioned you were doing the punch downs yourself. You're doing a lot of the labor post-harvest yourself, is that right?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And that was probably something you didn't see as much when you were working in California, where the winemakers really didn't do as much of that work.
Well, in California, I initially started focused in the vineyard. So I was on the viticultural end of things. My time at Rudd, I was like right in there, hands in the cellar. I did a lot of lab work over there.
So you were an enologist then?
For the harvest season, exactly. But yeah, this a smaller operation like this, we kind of bounce around 5,000, 6,000 cases. It's kind of like all hands on deck, and you're not, you're not exempt from any sort of project. You know.
No accountants, though. You want to keep the accountants out of the vineyard.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, still, but it's a, you know, it, whether you call it a family or not, it is a family thing. You're such a tight group of people because you're working hip to hip.
It is.
And you're working long hours. So,
it is.
Yeah, it's a major effort. So here's kind of the tricky question of the day, considering your lengthy experience in the business. What makes you crazy about the wine business?
You know, harvest itself can drive you crazy, but there are so many rewards after it. What really, besides the science and craft and just what a great profession that is to put those two together, I really enjoy tasting people through wine. Not because it makes me feel good about the wine I'm making, but because it's really fun to just like watch somebody's journey of discovery. And that's what wine, to me, that's what wine is about, the journey of discovery. It's not about drinking tons of wine. It's not about, you know, how what the price point of your wine is. It's about discovering and learning new things. So, and for myself, I'm no wine expert. That's what I love to do. I love to learn about other wines of the world. And when I'm around somebody who is a wine expert, I really try to pick their brain. Because it's easy to get what we call in the industry like a cellar palate. We're just so focused on what we're doing as our craft and what our wine style is and our, you know, how we can make our wine style better and our craft better and how that applies to the vineyard and our region and our weather and climate. So there's plenty of things for me to dive into that have nothing to do with world wines. So yeah, when I'm around a real world wine expert, I definitely listen up.
Well, and it's very humble of you to say you're not an expert, because of course that's the first thing people are going to assume. You are the expert of the wine you're making here.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have that knowledge, right? I mean, this is not a casual thing. And you're responsible. I mean, look at these tanks behind you. That's a lot of responsibility.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a cool thing to know that even as an expert in this cellar and as an expert in this region, there's so much more to learn. I mean, it's endless.
Yeah, it is. That's true. So do you make your own wine? I'm curious. Other than Shady Lane.
Oh, like my own label. I don't. Maybe someday. I'm not completely opposed to it. Right now, my focus is on Shady Lane and crafting the best wine we can for them. Just making sure we have a great team here, making sure there's cohesion between what goes on in the vineyard and what goes on in here and being able to execute that.
Sure. Now, you were saying you have a relatively small crew here. Have you, you know, many wineries, especially out west, have run into issues with labor, mm-hmm. trying to find good people to work? Is that something you've run into here?
Yes. And I think that in this particular area, it's not only because of, it's not only a problem in agriculture, it's a problem even in, you know, the hospitality industry, the tourism industry. It's just so vibrant and busy for 4 months out of the year. It's hard to ask anyone at any level to come up here and start a life when, you know, what are they going to do for the rest of the year? So it's something we kind of struggle with so much, especially on Leelanau Peninsula. So much of the population here are summertime residents. So there's this huge flux of people living here and not just not having that, you know,
sure,
the labor we need.
Does it get really quiet around here then over winter?
It does.
Really? Kind of creepy quiet?
It does. Sometimes. It's all of the smaller towns try to, we all have our, you know, winter festivals. Everybody comes out for that. Traverse City is, you know, it's a really bustling city, especially in the summertime. And winter is when you can walk into a restaurant and sit down and, you know, there's no problem finding a seat. Yeah. So as a local, we all kind of look forward to that downtime.
Sure, I'll bet. Now, you were saying you make roughly between 5,000 and 6,000 cases, if I recall. Do you distribute outside the area? Is it only strictly around here? Or?
We do. We are now in the Chicago market. Gaining some ground, especially with our semi-dry Riesling, our sparkling Riesling, the Blaufränkisch. We make a Frankenfranc, which is our proprietary blend. It's 43% Blaufränkisch, 43% Cabernet Franc, and 14% Merlot. And it is just a beautiful wine. I mean, that blend together, the different components that each wine brings as far as, like, you know, structure. The Cab Franc brings this great structure and tannin foundation, whereas the Blaufränkisch kind of, like, fills in. It's the mortar, it fills in all those gaps. The Merlot brings this like great roundness to it. So amazing, like cranberry and pomegranate fruits with like this rich kind of like dark bramble fruit as well.
So it's all about getting the word out.
It is. And then, you know, we're here and there in a couple other states and we have room to grow.
What we pulled up now, obviously for our listeners, they probably realize we're in a noisy room, which is the cellar, and it's a working cellar. Things are happening, a little, like you say, fermentation's happening and that sort of thing. But the tasting room is just up the road. It's a beautiful stone building. My God, a little outside area. I mean, all kinds of stuff. Is this by appointment or can people just drive on up? I mean, what's the situation?
People can just drive on up. We do have private tastings that are by appointment. We'll take you through the vineyard, that sort of thing. A lot more face-to-face conversation and just getting to know Shady Lane if you do a private tasting. But yeah, by appointment, you can stroll on in the summertime. The patio bar is open. Plenty of like seats on the patio. You can cozy up in an Adirondack chair right at the edge of the vineyard and enjoy a glass of wine.
Yeah, I saw the lonely chairs still sitting out there in the snow.
I know.
It's kind of like, please come back. And again, for our listeners who would like to learn a little bit more about you online, how would they do that?
Yes, it's shadylanecellars.com.
Excellent. Well, Casey, thanks very much for taking the time today. I appreciate your meeting on an early Saturday morning where it's cold as heck outside, and I wish you guys continued success.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Learn more by visiting ShadyLaneCellars.com or MichiganWineCollaborative.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2018.